This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 105, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. My mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases and other related events. And every Thursday I release an episode called UFO Encounters, so please check them out. If you want to hear the extended version of this interview, you'll need to join the Patreon campaign. Well, there are now more than 100 episodes in the back catalogue. For $5 a month, you get an extended episode every week. And for $2 a month, you get an extended episode every month. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe. This week, I'm talking to Dr. Diana Walsh-Pasulka about her book, Encounters, Experiences with Non-Human Intelligences. Dr. Pasulka is a professor of religious studies at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. Her works include American Cosmic, Heaven Can Wait, as well as two co-authored books about religion and technology. Diana's research spans Catholic history to modern-day reports of UAPs and UFOs. Her book, American Cosmic, has been featured in mainstream presses such as Vice, Vox, Fox News, Tank, the Los Angeles Review of Books, Publishers Weekly, and Kirkus Reviews. Additionally, she consults about religion and history for movies and television, including the movie The Conjuring. Hi, Diana. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me, Simon.
So we're going to talk about your book. It's called Encounters, Experiences with Non-Human Intelligences. You're a professor of the history of religion. So why is it you've got into UFOs? How did that come about?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I've been studying religion for a very long time, and I am a full professor at the University of North Carolina. And so basically, I've studied what are called ascent narratives in the Christian historical record. And ascent narratives have to do very much with ideas of what happens after you die, or if you're in a mystical state and your soul leaves your body, things like that in the Christian tradition. And there are a lot of ascent narratives. There's even one in the New Testament with the Apostle Paul. There's also recorded in the New Testament an ascent narrative with Jesus, the Transfiguration, where he ascends basically like a levitation or a lifting up of a person's body or their what people determine to be their souls. And so Dante's Divine Comedy is a good example of an early modern medieval, late medieval ascent narrative, basically, where he's traveling through the afterlife and kind of viewing it. Near-death experiences are modern-day versions of ascent narratives. So these occur in lots of different cultures, and they occur throughout time. And what happened was that in 2012, I just finished a book about ascent narratives, basically this doctrine of purgatory. And it was a survey of purgatory, this Catholic doctrine, basically of where your soul goes post-death. And what happened was that when I was doing a lot of the research, I do research in libraries of old manuscripts, which are called archives. So, you know, I'd been doing about 10 years of this research in these dusty archives all over the place. Even in Ireland. And what I found was that not only did I come across reports of aerial phenomena from 1200 through the 1800s, which was my time period, but I also came across a lot of narratives about spinning discs, orbs that could go through walls and things like this. Flying houses, you know, things that I didn't quite understand. And they happened through the centuries. And so I took I took notes about these things. And I had like a lot of notes at the end of my research on purgatory. And at the end of that, I, you know, published my book and I was on to the next project, which would be a look at this bishop here in the colonies, the 1700s and in the United States. And so, but I showed a friend of mine these these notes that I had about the aerial phenomena. And he took a look at it and he said, this looks a lot like Steven Spielberg work, like UFOs. And I thought he was crazy. He said, yeah, right. But there was a conference in town just after that. And it was focused on people who had UFO experiences. And so I went to the conference. And when I went there, I listened to people who are called experiencers. And they talked about their own, what I would call ascent narratives, you know, with these basically what they thought were UFOs. And I realized that there was this transhistorical kind of, you know, line from, you know, the history from, you know, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 300 years ago, throughout today. So I decided to turn my research lens to look at modern reports of UFOs, kind of looking at them through the lens of my research, which was on ascent narratives. And that's how it started. And there were a lot of correlations and connections and patterns. And but it just got a lot different than what I had thought it would be. And it took off. And from there, I met people who were scientists who were doing studies of experiencers and what they thought were, you know, crash retrieval parts and things like that. And these were people from like Stanford University and our own Space Force. So this was really shocking to me. So I could see that the research that I had done previously had morphed into something completely different than I had anticipated.
And when you started looking into UFOs, if you compare your viewpoint on UFOs before you started your research to how it is now, would you say it's a lot stranger and complicated than you expected?
Absolutely. So when I wrote the first book on UFOs, which was American Cosmic, I inherited the stereotypes that we all have about UFOs being nuts and bolts, craft from other places in either our galaxy or other galaxies, that, you know, they have these, if they exist, extraterrestrials, these have advanced technology, they somehow make it to our solar system and our planet atmosphere. And, you know, and we were taught to think this way through media, of course, and science fiction, and, you know, no problem there. You know, that's the inherited stereotype. But when I got into the actual study of it, it was so much more than that and so much more complicated. And actually, there were a lot of religious and spiritual themes that ran through it. So when I went to title my next book about it, my editor actually said, Diana, is this a book about UFOs? And I said, well, it is actually a book about UFOs, but UFOs are not what people think they are. And so he said, well, let's just change the title. And so he suggested that we call it, you know, the NHI, non-human intelligence, and, you know, the spectrum of it. So he included this very long after title to the title of it is Encounters. But he was right, because, you know, I think a lot of people have a stereotype, like I did, about UFOs. But when you actually start to talk to people who have these experiences, and you talk to scientists, even fighter pilots who have, you know, who confront them in the sky and things like that, those ideas and stereotypes, you have to leave them behind.
Do you quote Carl Jung in the book, who said UFOs are technological angels? So what did he mean by that?
Yeah. I like that, because what he's doing is he's combining a historical narrative of what we thought of as these beings that we encounter coming down from who knows where, you know, from the sky. We see them in the sky, and they often come down and engage with human beings. And we've called those angels in the Christian, Jewish, you know, even Islamic heritage, right? This is the monotheistic heritage of the West. And so Carl Jung is basically saying they're technological. So that brings it into the age of technology. So that's why I used his term technological angels, because it inflects, you know, with a modern idea, it inflects an interpretive framework. Basically, we used to interpret them this way. They're still here. We now interpret them this way.
Do you also talk about astronauts and their view of Earth and how it changed some way, and almost astronauts became more spiritual and their viewpoint of mankind changed?
Yeah. So I began a study of this by doing a historical review of any literature I could find about the history of the space programs that were viable from the early 20th century. And those, of course, would be the Russian space program and the United States space program. I'm talking about both Russia and the United States, had the viable technology and, calculations, rocket calculations to get us off planet. All right. So that said, it was an interesting history on both sides. And part of what I did also for Encounters was I had met a lot of people who were, involved in these different space programs. And one of the people I met was Dr. Ea Whiteley, and she's at University College London. And she's actually what's called a space psychologist. She may have even invented that, that discipline. And she's worked with pilots, and she's worked with people who are involved in aviation and aerospace and extreme environments like this. And these are really extreme environments. The people that are chosen to become astronauts and even pilots, they have to have certain skills. And so what she does is she helps in identifying the people, and then she helps to help them deal with these extreme environments. And what has been observed, and she wasn't the first to observe this, I think it was Frank Wright called and coined this, the overview effect. So when astronauts leave Earth, they have an overview of Earth that no one else has had. So they leave Earth only maybe in our either astral projections or imaginations have we had this if we're not astronauts. But astronauts physically go off planet and they see Earth from space. And this really, now there are simulations for astronauts so that they're not as shocked when they get out there. We have virtual simulations for them, which help prepare them for these experiences that they have. But it definitely impacts them while they're there and after they get back. And so there's been anthropological analyses of, what astronauts say about what they feel. And there have been astronauts just talking about it. And some astronauts, especially those recent astronauts who've been trained in virtual environments, they're fine. They're okay. They don't have as shocking an experience. But a lot of people, Dr. Whiteley said that when people leave Earth and the further they get from Earth, the further they are susceptible to a sort of panic that they're not even aware of. And she's able to analyze their voices and to identify if they're, if they're actually experiencing, and then to help them. Or if they somehow lose contact with us, through technological error or something like that. She prepares them for that as well. They're out there and the environment looks so incredibly odd. A lot of the first astronauts, and there's a culture of non-reporting. So these people have trained their whole lives to go into space and they don't go there for very long. So if there's anything that would jeopardize their ability to get into space, they're not going to report it. And one of those would be something like, if they're mentally upset, they're, a lot of times they wouldn't be allowed back. And so they're not going to report that. And this is data, though, that we need. So Dr. Whiteley has been really instrumental in getting the information about their, the kinds of things that they encounter in mental states, basically different forms of consciousness when they get into these environments. She actually was at this organization. This is the Soul Foundation. Dr. Gary Nolan, who I know and work with, he is a professor at Stanford, and he put on a conference. Like a month ago or so. And Dr. Whiteley gave a really great talk where she talked about the reticence of astronauts and even pilots to talk about the anomalous things that they see or experience. And one of the examples she used was people who were astronauts would come back and they would, when they closed their eyes or when they went to bed, they would see lights and stars. They said, they would see these things, lights and stars, and they wouldn't report these. And finally, when enough of them came back, they talked amongst themselves and they basically said, look, this is not normal. We need to report this, but we don't want to get fired. So they reported it together because they knew that they couldn't fire all of them. And she used this as an example of just some of the weird things that happened to them in space, but also the fear of reporting these things, which, you know, is very significant.
And so there's a thing there where astronauts can be affected by having that viewpoint of the Earth, which I think Edgar Mitchell was very affected by it. But there's an effect on people when they see UFOs that it's, for some of them, it's not just, oh yeah, I've seen a UFO, but other stuff starts happening then. It's like there's a paranormal effects that occur afterwards.
Yes. Okay. So this is Jacques Vallée, and I don't think he's the person who came up with this term, but he could have been. It's called the contact effects. Okay. And not everyone has them, but a lot of people do. And sometimes they can just be in the vicinity of where UFOs had been spotted, and they'll have these effects, even if they didn't see them themselves. And this is also, there's a term for this called the sphere of influence. And so there is a naval intelligence person who was on the USS Roosevelt during the Tic Tac episode, and his name is Matthew Roberts. You may have had him on your show. He's really interesting.
Yeah, his book is Initiated, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah. So I've talked to him about what happened to him, because obviously a lot of these things happened to him after the Tic Tac episode occurred. And I asked him, why do you think these happened to you and they didn't happen to everyone, or they happened to some people, but not everyone? And he had a really very interesting response. And he said that he'd already been involved in kind of doing a lot of psychological maturity work, you know, something akin to kind of a spiritual practice. And so he'd already in many ways prepared himself, and he thought he'd prepared himself to receive whatever it was that the Tic Tacs were there, or that, you know, UFOs or UAPs were there to present. And he said that he felt like he was activated by that episode, whereas other people who hadn't been engaged in that type of psychological work, they weren't activated.
People have weird things, don't they? It's like they might get little psychic flashes or synchronicities happen in their lives. And it's so weird that would start happening after you've seen a UFO.
Yes, I agree. I think it's there's a correlation, and I'm not quite sure what the correlation is, to tell you the truth, but you see the effects happening to a lot of people. A lot of people are shocked. And in my opinion, what's happening is that these kinds of effects, you see them in religious traditions, especially within monastic religious aspects of traditions. So let's take, you know, certain, like Buddhism or Hinduism or monastic Christianity, you have people who are doing what Matthew did. They're doing practices of prayer, intense devotions and meditations. And, you know, they're basically doing psychological maturity work, right? So they're living a very mature, sober life. And what happens is that they also experience these kinds of effects. Oftentimes they also see things in aerial objects in the sky or beings and things like that. Within those religious traditions, they're told not to pay attention to those, that those are distractions from the actual work. But if you get a secular person, a person who does not have this tradition and is not aware that these traditions even exist, they happen to be involved in a UFO event and they have these after effects, it's really shocking to them.
Well, I've got this idea that UFOs fly around with lights on and they show themselves to people, and they're doing it on purpose because it seems like they could fly around with their lights off. So they want people to see them. And perhaps sometimes they're doing it to you. They've come to this particular person who is on some kind of a path. You might call it a spiritual path or a paranormal path maybe, but the UFO is giving them another step on their path, or giving them a kick in the pants, or kind of saying, hey, pay attention to the universe. Is that a mad idea?
No, I don't think so. But I also have to say that there's a tradition, you can see it in the historical tradition, and you can also see it in the research of people who do UAP studies today, that a lot of these events, not all of them, but some of them are, you know, what we would term, we don't want that to happen to us. They didn't feel or interpret it to be spiritual. They interpret it to be, you know, some pilots get crash into these things, and or, you know, it's a dangerous situation. Some people have had burns, you know, that develop after they've seen these things. People that I've talked to, when they, you know, some people who see these often and look at them, their eyes hurt, you know, and they have some kind of damage to their eyes. So I wouldn't say, you know, we have to be really careful if we suggest that, you know, it is a good spiritual thing. It may actually be something that's spiritual, but it could also be, have some seriously unfortunate effects.
Now, I suppose this is the, when it gets so complicated and trying to work out what's going on, because some experience will say that their contact with ETs is all love and light, and there are other experiences say, no, it was all bad. And
yes,
we
yes.
can't simplify the whole phenomenon.
No, you can't. That's what makes it really maddening but actually I think that in religious studies, we're used to that because we study religion. We don't actually come, you know, we don't come at it from this is true or false. We have a line that we walk where we don't confirm or deny. And that's, we're trained that way. That's what we do. We study religion from different perspectives, like archaeology, sociology. We have different traditions from which we come to study religion. So the field of religious studies, I think, is a really good way to get into studying this kind of data.
And do you feel that this phenomena we have nowadays of UFOs has been around for thousands of years? And perhaps that has influenced people thousands of years ago within religion.
Okay, so it seems to be, as long as human culture has been around, people have either in oral traditions spoken of aerial phenomena that engage with them. And there are historical records that indicate that's also the case. Yes.
I kind of have this feeling with near-death experiences that perhaps people had them thousands of years ago, and that was an influence on religion as well, because people would come back and say, this is what I saw while I was dead.
Are you familiar with the near-death experience, the myth of Ur in Plato's Republic?
I did read something about Plato and near-death experiences, but I can't remember the details.
Yeah, so this is exactly what he says in there. So this is Plato's Republic. It's one of the most significant, philosophical texts in the Western tradition. And it's written about 2,450 or so years ago. And it's basically, in Plato's Republic, he's basically asking the question, how do we create a just society? And he has a dialogue in there. He has two characters, his teacher Socrates and his brother Glaucon. And they're having a dialogue about whether or not this could possibly be the case. And for every chapter, they kind of go through different scenarios. And he doesn't actually say, no, this won't work. Or, you know, he basically just moves on to another scenario. But at the very end of it, he presents two different scenarios. And I think that these are very, very important, although a lot of people gloss over them when they either teach it or read it. And one of them is about this soldier who Socrates says, I heard this experience that this soldier had. He died on the battlefield and he went to, you know, he went to a place. And in this place, it was a lot of people were basically choosing what kind of life they were going to have for their next life. And it all depended on what kind of life they had, right? So were they, you know, did they do the things they were supposed to do, right? And so a lot of things happened in this way station that he talks about. And then he gets resuscitated. He comes back and he tells the story. So this is one of the first actual recorded near-death experiences. And I think it's really interesting that it's in this philosophical text that, you know, if you take philosophy 101 at university, this, you're going to read this. And I think it's really interesting.
And it also kind of suggests the reincarnation, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. It suggests a form of reincarnation. It also suggests a form of judgment, because there is, you know, depending on how you lived in this life, you choose, but you also have to choose within certain parameters. That's made very clear in the Republic.
So we change the subject. We get back to the book because the book's so great. We're supposed to be doing UFO podcast, and I think we're going off track here. There's something in the book you say about scientists who are really into UFO research start to have experiences, which such as vivid dreams and non-linear experiences of time. And it's the phrase that it reminds me of is they say, when you start looking at this, it starts looking back.
That's right. Yeah. That I think comes from, that's been appropriated by Nietzsche. And he wasn't talking about UFOs though. He was talking about the mystery of life in general, but I think this definitely applies. When you look into the abyss, don't be surprised if it looks back. And, so a lot of the people in my book who are scientists have had experiences, and then they became scientists. And then they, after, you know, they went through what amounts to like a 10-year process at their jobs, they used their methods and their training to look at the topic, because of course they're fascinated because it happened to them. So I do have various UFO scientist experiencers featured in my book. And I did this in American Cosmic too. And one of the more interesting people that I met is a Nobelist. So he won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for discovering the polymerase chain reaction. And his name is Dr. Kerry Mullis. And he was really interesting. So he had an experience that he called it a UFO experience, but again, it was a very weird experience that once you learn about it, it defies the stereotypes of a UFO, right? That we even, the inherited stereotype. So he's obviously a very well-known chemist. He's at UC Berkeley in California, and he has a cabin in the woods. And so he's going to this cabin, and as he's walking to it at night, he sees to his side something that he says looks like a raccoon, or he thinks it's a raccoon, but it's all, he said it looked on fire or electric, like an electric, he called it an electric raccoon. And he looked at it and it looked back at him and it said, "Good evening, Dr. Mullis." And he said something back to it that was, you know, something like, "Oh yeah, yeah, good evening," or something like that, which obviously would not be something that you or I would think to say. So a lot of these kinds of experiences involve what I've heard to be the sphere of influence, where not just space-time is altered, but your own reactions become something when you look back on, you say, wow, why did I react that way? So he said that he doesn't remember anything else except for the next day, waking up, walking, fully dressed, and walking on his property. And of course, this was shocking to him. And so he was inclined to get his, he owns a shotgun. So he got his shotgun and he went and he pelleted with shots the area where he saw the raccoon. And then he started to read everything he could about UFOs. And I met him and talked to him about that. But people in the book in encounters, so there's a person who does work in Department of Defense type of stuff, aerospace stuff. And he had experiences and has experiences, and they're not just of the typical gray aliens that people talk about. He does have experiences of those, but he also has experiences of what Christians and, you know, Jewish people, even people, Muslims would call, you know, Michael the Archangel. Okay, so Michael the Archangel is there's even a pre-Christian entity that looks like Michael the Archangel. Looks like this very, you know, big being with that seems to have wings or flies and carries a sword. And so he had experiences of Saint Michael too. So there's not just experiences of, you know, these things that are associated with UFOs like gray aliens, but there are also these other beings that people also have experiences with.
And with Carrie Mullis, this encounter with the raccoon and the missing time he had, he's sure that wasn't a dream or something, isn't he? That he was in his normal waking state, just like we are now?
Yeah, a lot of people, even in the historical record, by the way, there is a nun from the 1500s, a Spanish nun, Teresa of Avila. She wrote about her own very odd experience of a small, shiny being. And she said, I was awake. I didn't imagine this, and I wasn't asleep. And that's basically what everybody tells me, almost with the same terminology. They insist, I was awake. I did imagine this. It was not a dream.
And another thing about Carrie Mullis, sorry, keep going back there, but...
Oh, yeah, he's great.
It's this thing that he remembers it, because it seems like he had that cut. It's almost like they've spliced the film where he goes from one point to finding himself walking along in daytime. And so there's a whole load of missing time there that's cut out of his life. He doesn't remember it. And if they can do that to him at that point, why didn't they just cut all of it out and he doesn't remember any of it? Is it because they messed up or because they wanted him to remember?
Yeah, that's such a great question. And this goes to Jacques Vallée's idea of the control mechanism. So he sees he calls it the phenomena, because, you know, it's really hard to say what it is or conclude. So he leaves it open. And he basically is suggesting that it works like a control mechanism. He knows that it's giving us information, but not the entire story. So we can't conclude. We have to wonder and we have to guess and we have to make some assumptions as well. So, you know, why do a lot of people only have partial memories? Or why do people sometimes remember after the fact? What happened in my research was that I began to explore John Mack suggested this thing called ontological shock. And he's not the first to use that term, but he made it very popular that when people recognize that what they thought was an imaginary thing was actually real, they experience a shock to their system. So I started to explore this, and it brought me to Sigmund Freud. Actually wrote an essay called The Uncanny in 1919, where he talks about what the uncanny is. And he calls it a species of terror, that is a form of terror. And a lot of it has to do with things that you learned about in childhood that you believed were true, that when, you know, you lose that belief when you're like, I don't know, 8, 9 years old, maybe 12, I don't know. You know, you lose these beliefs and you're like, okay, now I don't believe in that anymore. But they come back when people have these experiences and there's a terror, or this type of terror that Freud calls the uncanny, when you realize that those things that you believed in as a child are actually true. And this is uncanny. This is a feeling of just something not being right. It's being very uncanny, basically. I thought it was a really good essay and even a better description than ontological shock.
So can you tell us about the gray man? Because I think you do 2 chapters with him, don't you? And that's fascinating.
Yeah. So the gray man is a man who works in aerospace, and is Australian. And so he had, there are some people in the book who I identified as having experiences when they were young that were well known and basically corroborated by radar and multiple witnesses, events. UFO flaps is what they're called. And in New South Wales, Australia, in the I think it's the 1990s, the late 1990s or mid 1990s, there were a series of UFO flaps, and many, many, many people saw them. And it's a well-documented UFO experience for a lot of different people. And he was a person during this time that saw something like this and had this experience, but he forgot about it. And then he went on to become a scientist. And then he began to study. He began to meet people who were involved in the study of UAPs, UFOs. And he also had ongoing experiences, that the kind of typical abduction type experiences with grays and things like that, that he didn't like. He thought they were terrible. He didn't want to have these experiences. So he had ongoing experiences, and still does, of these kinds of paranormal things. Certain types of synchronicities would happen to him. Knowing things that he didn't know how he knew them, but he would, like, kind of almost like a precognition. And when I met him, we met because we were doing research on this topic, and I was meeting people like him, scientists who were involved in this research. And so he was, so I involved him in the book because his experiences were very, I would call them they were pretty typical of people who, scientists, who they would generally have some kind of experience in their past that they would then forget about. And then somehow they would have these experiences throughout their life and then go into, like, aerospace industry and then, you know, have, you know, be involved in these kinds of UAP study groups.
It sort of sounds like what I was thinking of before, where they'd have that UFO experience when they're young, and that sets them up to be on this path to go into science and then eventually end up studying UFOs. Maybe I'm going into this too much, but it seems, you know, that they wanted him to do it, so they set them up for it.
It's kind of strange, but I've met so many people who are academics and scientists who had experiences as children, and they describe what happened to them as children. And a lot of times they believe that they were shown things and they didn't understand them at the time. And then when they grew up, they decided at university or whatnot to go into a specific field. And then that field would provide them with the training they needed to understand their childhood vision.
Yeah, it's like there's a plan, as though whatever these non-human intelligences are, they wanted these people to do this. But the question is, why? What are they leading us to?
Right. So, Simon, I have some ideas about that, but I haven't actually talked about it publicly, but I'm happy to do so. But these are different kinds of ideas about how to think about it. Like, instead of thinking about it as these aliens orchestrating us, there's another way to look at it, I think.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
Okay. So this involves working with people in artificial intelligence communities. And what I noticed about them is that they have their own language. It's English, but it's English with a lot of different technological overlay. And so it takes a while to kind of understand what they're talking about. But I believe that they're onto something. And this has to do also with this idea of where language comes from. Okay, so what is language? And I follow a lot of the theories about how humans adopt languages. And there are a lot of theories. But I think some of the ones that have stayed around basically believe that languages are emergent. That means that at some point they just happen. And nobody kind of knows how that process works. Thus, we have a lot of people working on that problem. Like, how does this work? You know, what are the steps and processes whereby we as humans, you know, cultivate language? All right. That's looking at it from our perspective. Looking at it from another perspective is that, I don't know if in biology you're aware, but a lot of biologists talk about viruses and humans as the hosts of viruses, right? So we, you know, the virus lives and we're its host. So that's looking at it from the virus's perspective, right? So the virus is like, it's gonna use humans as a host, and it's gonna try to travel as much as it can and expand from human to human. And we really can't do anything about it, right? If we try to learn as much as we can about the virus so that we won't allow it to replicate, but that's how it replicates. So I think if we're trying to understand the topic of the UAP and the UFO and how it engages with humans, I think we have to understand it as from its perspective instead of from our perspective, because we're trying to figure it out. But what's really happening is that it's basically works like language, or it works like a virus in a sense. It's emerging through our experiences of it, right? So it's emerging through our talking about it. Here I am talking about it on your podcast. A lot of people are going to listen to this. So it's emerging through us collectively. And so we have to start thinking about it from that perspective instead of thinking about it from, because I think that we're not going to get anywhere if we continue to think, you know, what is it doing? Why is it doing this? We're thinking about it in human terms. I think it's much more, I think it's honestly alien. And if it's alien, we have to think about it more in terms of systems. Like, how does it engage with us and why? Well, it looks much more like it's a language, or much more like it's a virus of some sort.
So in a way, it's in a different dimension or universe or some other space-time place, and it's kind of emerging and putting itself into our dimension, our universe.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think that we're becoming aware of it, and it's an emergent. But emergent is a very slippery term, and a lot of people use that word. But, you know, what does it actually mean? So I listened to a podcast, the Lex Fridman podcast, and he was interviewing that he was an ex-AI head of Google, and he's on his own now. Karpathy is his last name, and I don't know what his first name. I can't remember his first name. But they were talking about AI. And, you know, maybe even like generative AI, or, you know, AI that could reproduce itself. And they were also talking about coding and computer coding. And so they were using, you know, and they were talking about the processes, but they couldn't actually replicate in words these processes because they eluded them. And so finally they both said, oh, well, it's probably just an emergent phenomenon. And this was a while ago that I heard that, and I thought, what does that even mean, an emergent phenomenon? So I began to do, you know, I started to ask friends of mine who do AI, what do you mean when you say that? And even people in biology, and, you know, and what it actually means is that there's something that is utilizing human behaviors or human culture to be in existence, to become, you know, existent. And that could be very well like language or stories or, you know, things that we, you know, it needs our human, you know, behaviors in order to exist.
And so when we see things here, whether it's ETs or UFOs, in some way we're a partner with it, and we can imprint upon it something from us?
Yeah, it seems that we're, well, I don't like to use the word, but it seems like we're like hosts of it. So just like viruses need human beings in order to replicate and exist, so does that. So does this thing that we call UAP, UFOs.
So anybody who thinks they might be here to invade and take over and kill us all, that's the last thing they do.
Well, they haven't done it yet. I mean, you know, like I said, as long as human cultures have been here, they've been, you know, talking about different forms of aerial phenomena that come down and engage with humans. And we're still here.
As I heard somebody who was an experiencer, they encountered this ET, and the ET said to them, "What we look like to you is what you imprint upon us. Where we come from, we don't have physical form." And I've wondered about this, about how come when people say they see these ETs, they may be greys, they may be reptilians or Nordics, these different types, they're always humanoid. They always got two arms, two legs. And it seems weird. And I think there are scientists who would say if intelligent life evolved on other planets, there's no reason why they should be the same shape as us.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I think that when, and I have some examples of this in encounters, that a lot of times, and even in American Cosmic, I go through this with this experiencer who was atheist and now is a believer, but like a non-denominational believer. And his wife is a Catholic, and they both saw what he termed a UFO, and they both had differing interpretations of what it was. He thought it was like a plasma entity, and she thought it was an angel. Okay. So again, this is repeated in encounters. There's a well-known flap from upstate New York, Brockport, in 1967. And I met a person who experienced that when he was about 16. And I looked at all the historical reports of it. It was a well-reported event by credible witnesses like police officers and teachers and, you know, all kinds of people. And people saw different things. So one person actually saw, the first report of it was of a craft with little beings on it. And that was actually dismissed. And then all these other people saw like kind of like a beautiful craft in the sky, you know, multicolored and beautiful and things like that. And those were actually accepted. So it's really interesting what we accept as a credible report and what we think is a dubious report. You know, they were all reports. They saw different things. So it could be. So people who I did feature in the book, like Simone in one of the chapters, she does quantum computing and AI. And so her idea is that this phenomena is outside of our space-time. And when it interfaces with us, we actually, just as you had mentioned from the person that you just described and his experience of his ET, is that, yeah, we're going to bring our own frameworks to understanding what it is, because we do that anyway with reality. We're taught to see what we see. And so it just so happens that we have a consensus about what we see. But with this phenomena, we generally do, a lot of times we just don't have a consensus because we don't know what we're seeing. So she thinks that it's interfacing with us from outside of our three-dimensional reality.
Which is one of the reasons, I suppose, it's so strange and so much weird stuff comes up. Because
yeah, I think so.
With the gray man, didn't he have an experience where he woke up and there was this face right in front of him, and he said to this entity, "Can I hug you?" And the entity said, "No, because I got a sword and you would get hurt."
That's correct. That's the St. Michael entity. I mean, when he told me about that, I immediately assumed he knew what St. Michael was, like the whole history, you know, the iconography of St. Michael, the archangel. But he didn't. And I didn't know that until later on. And so he didn't know that, you know, he was having this experience of something he had no understanding of, but he identified it right as this. And this is where the union archetypes actually seem to be something that could possibly be a thing, kind of like mathematics, right? Objective in some kind of space, where, you know, like numbers and things like that. Not, you know, there are math realists like that believe that numbers have objective reality outside of humans. And then there are people who don't believe that, who are mathematicians. And so in religion, you have angel realists, right? Where these things are, you know, like Jung, Carl Jung's archetypes. That's, you know, he has kind of a realistic idea that these are objective kinds of things that happen in human consciousness that we can all access. And it seems to have happened with Gray Man. Gray Man identified something that, you know, that I then told him. I said, well, this is actually an entity within the Christian tradition.
Well, it's been great talking to you. The book is Encounters, Experiences with Non-Human Intelligences. And people can get that on Amazon and all sorts of places, can't they?
They can, anywhere books are sold.
Yeah, excellent. Maybe you could come back and we'll talk about your other books sometime.
That would be great, Simon. Love to do it.
Great. Well, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Absolutely. You take care.
And that was an interview with Dr. Diana Walsh-Basolka about her book, Encounters, Experiences with Non-Human Intelligences. And a great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can hear the extended episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. If you join the $2 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month. If you join the $5 a month tier, you'll have access to an extended episode every week. And when you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and released 2 days before the free versions. And please check out my other podcast. It's called Past Lives Podcast. There are over 290 episodes. On the Past Lives podcast, I look into evidence of an afterlife, such as near-death experiences, children with past life memories, mediumship, deathbed visions, and other phenomena. I also release an extra episode of the Past Lives podcast every Thursday, and that's called Paranormal Stories. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and the link is in the show notes. And in my work as a clinical hypnotherapist, I take people through past life regression. And when you book a past life regression hypnosis session with me and you've signed up to Patreon, you get a 25% discount. And I'm offering a free consultation call, which can be booked on my website. My Instagram is the Past Lives Podcast with an underscore between each word. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening. You've been studying this stuff. Has it started looking back at you? Has anything come up?
Okay, so that's a great question and a good way to put it, by the way. I would say that in my life,